Hello, and welcome to episode 225 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Today, we look back at our recent series inspired by Rick's lecture series titled The Search for Meaning. Over the past several weeks, we've explored truth, goodness, love, beauty, the soul, justice, and nature, each revealing a different dimension of what it means to live a meaningful life. For this final episode, we're stepping back to look at the series as a whole. Why meaning matters, how these themes fit together, and where Rick's work on turning this into a book now stands. So, Rick, let's start here. You've argued that searching for meaning isn't a philosophical luxury. It's something people increasingly feel they need to do. Why do you think the search for meaning is such an urgent task, especially right now?
I think it is because we're living in a society that is filled more and more with distractions. And this is partly the effect of the digital life where we've got all this personalized entertainment and what we're living in what's called the attention economy. So there's all this stuff coming at us trying to demand our attention, but we feel ourselves distracted. We experience meaning when we feel that our lives are connected to something greater than ourselves, not just our own personal pursuits, not just entertainment, but something that's important in some way. When we live in this society that is more and more focused on distraction, and it's also more individualized, we don't have, most of us don't have regular kind of practices that connect us the way that earlier societies always did to things that are greater. And that's like church, civic groups, various kinds of rituals and traditions that just kind of lead us into that. And it's something that we do because everybody does in our society. Most of us don't live in that kind of connected way anymore. And so finding meaning in our lives has fallen to the individual to try to do rather than something that just kind of happens to you as a matter of course.
I want to get back to some of those points in a second, but I just wanted to hit the rewind button a little bit and sort of take listeners on a journey as to how we got to this spot. For regular listeners of the show, they know that we started talking about these themes. I think it was in October, and was there 8 weeks of this? Is that right?
7 weeks.
7 weeks, yep. Sorry. And so every 2 weeks, you held a public lecture at your college here in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and we followed that up kind of based on the discussions, and I was able to attend most of those lectures and every couple of weeks talked about those topics that we led the show with, you know, truth, goodness, et cetera. But obviously the planning for this did not start in October. The planning that you did for this started well before then. And so maybe just for a minute, talk about like how this whole idea came to be, because this obviously was pretty intentional and something that I'm sure took a lot of planning and thought on your part. So what was sort of the spark that ignited this?
You know, I don't know if there was a single spark. I've been thinking for years, for many years, about doing a book on certain key ideas, the ideas that give meaning to our lives. I wasn't sure what those ideas would be. I was pretty sure like truth, goodness, beauty would be among them. I had this sense that like these things that I had learned as an undergraduate and the things that I'd read and the things that we talked about weren't really being talked about much in universities anymore. And I was just noticing like they're not talked about much in our broader society. And yet I continue to be approached by people who seem to me to be really searching for something, some connection to something. And I'm thinking like, so we have all these people searching for something, but we're not talking about the things that actually provide meaning. And so I just thought there's an opportunity to do it. The other thing, I mean, the thing that prompted it for me this fall was I had an opening in my schedule. One of my classes got canceled, so I suddenly had time, and a class that I normally taught on Monday nights wasn't there, and I already had blocked off Monday nights. And I thought, why don't I just do a lecture series on Monday nights this semester?
I think you said there were seven. I was able to make it to five of those in person. And, you know, they were pretty well attended by the community. And clearly you were right that there was an interest in this. And certainly those shows have resonated and those topics have resonated with our listeners on this podcast. You said there were seven. And was it always seven? Was there a topic that just like didn't quite make the cut as you were sort of setting this outline probably over the summer?
Seven is more or less arbitrary, but there's been ideas that I thought of that could be in there. But what I was looking for is certain key ideas that, as I mentioned, connect us to something greater, but also ideas that have a natural integrity. That is, they can't be broken down and explained away by something else. One of the things I think is really regrettable about the world we live in right now is there's an attempt to explain everything that we find meaningful as a byproduct of our neuropsychology. Different ideas like goodness, for example, or love explained by, well, it's certain neurons firing in a certain region of the brain. And if you stimulate the brain in this way, people have this experience. If you stimulate it differently, they have different experiences. As if everything we think and we feel is just a byproduct of our brains. And I don't think that's the case. I think when we try to explain things away like that, we don't get at the essence of what they are. We only get at the essence of what they are by talking about the content of the idea. And so that's what I was trying to do in this series.
And as you were preparing for these seven lecture topics, and as we were, you know, preparing for these podcasts, was there a particular topic that just seemed to be tougher for you to get at or to, kind of frame up in a way that fit the series well? Or did it all come pretty naturally as you were? I'm guessing first that you, I think, set out, here's the seven topics, and then you sort of dug into them one after another and through all seven, I guess. So if I understand that workflow correctly, was there one that you started digging into it and you just realized that it was tougher than maybe you first expected?
There were several, like the topic of the soul, I found like really like hard to figure out a way to talk about it that was really precise in that I could do some kind of justice to it in a 30-minute lecture. So that was really hard. Also, like the idea of goodness was really tough, and I didn't anticipate that it would be. So like a few of them I found more problematic. Other ones that I thought are going to be pretty easy because they're topics that I've thought about a lot and written about a lot, like justice.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, like I had all these ideas for how I would focus a lecture on justice and what I'd do. I realized that I had way too much to say. And like then the question wasn't, how do I find something to say about it? How do I pare it down so I focus on one particular aspect of justice?
And when I saw the list, because I think you shared the list with me and probably others, you know, of the seven topics, I think you ended with nature. And I thought, well, that's one that Rick, you and I talk about a lot. And I thought that's, you know, I guess I had two thoughts. One, that's going to be easy for you in some ways. And two, that you put it at the end. And maybe that was why you put it at the end, because it was sort of like less of a heavy lift than some of the other ones. But I guess two things. One, is that generally right or not? And two, was the order pretty intentional? And how you started with truth and ended with nature, was that pretty intentionally ordered?
It was very intentionally ordered, and it was ordered based on the thinkers that I find most representative of each idea. So for each topic, I focus on one particular thinker. So with truth, I focused on Socrates. With goodness, I focused on Plato. For love, I focused on Augustine. And so there's a temporal order there. And there's also what I wanted to show is how these ideas become interdependent. As we get to Augustine talking about love, he is looking back on Plato's explanations of goodness and truth as a way of formulating an understanding of what love is. And so by the time we get to nature, which is the seventh, I was looking at Aldo Leopold, who's a 20th century figure, but he's also relying on all these earlier ideas to understand, like, how do we appreciate and care for nature and understand what it is? It's dependent on all these other concepts. So that was the reason for the order. And in what I'm planning to write out of this, the book, what I will be doing is showing how these ideas in a way become increasingly complex because they're dependent on the ideas that have already been expressed and understood in a certain way in the past. And so that right now we are living at a time in which we have this inheritance of all these really profound ways of connecting with something greater in our lives, and it's really rich. But you have to kind of dive back kind of systematically into the past to understand it.
And you just talked on it now, so I guess this is the right time to talk more about it, is that your plan is to turn this into a book. Your last book about third places was, what, a couple of years ago?
It was published a little over a year ago.
Oh, okay.
But I was writing it, you know, like 3 years ago was working on it.
Yeah. So I guess maybe tell me and the folks listening where you're at in the process for this book, because, you know, like I'm sure with the third places book, this doesn't come together over a long weekend.
No, and it comes together over a fairly long period of time. So where I am right now is I've just finished the lecture series. Mm-hmm. That we finished the series of podcasts along with it. I've got notes on each of these. And so as preparing the lecture, I've been doing a lot of reading, taking a lot of notes. And so that's what I've got. I've got a big stack of notes. I will have to do a lot more reading, a lot more thinking about each one of these, and then work through it. And I anticipate that I'll be doing that for the next year. So I'm hoping by about this point next year, by the end of the summer, I have something like a rough draft of it.
And it I guess it's probably too early to get a commitment from you, but it sounds like it's going to, in some broad way, focus on these same seven topics that your lecture series outline and our podcasts outline. That's sort of the spine of this.
Yeah, and doing the lecture series was, in a way, me trying to find out, is it really feasible?
Mm-hmm.
Because when you think about something in general, you kind of have a map or a picture of what you want to do, but then you dive into it and you find out, like, that's just not going to work. It doesn't hang together or something. What I found as I went along talking about each of these ideas, I found that there was much more kind of connection among these ideas than I had appreciated. I started to see lines both for more research and for more thinking about these topics than I had anticipated. And so it's a really rich area for study. I also want to tie it, something I didn't do in the lecture series, is tied into this present need that we have in our society right now because that we're living in such an age of distraction. I want to tie it into that in a way and frame it up as this is what happens when individuals have to dive in. What we need is help, because I had all kinds of help in trying to understand what these ideas are, what they meant, and so forth. And I had professors and even a program like, there was a program on PBS. I encountered this in high school. Like many of these ideas, the first time I encountered them was Steve Allen, who was a comedian. Mm-hmm. He had been a radio comedian.
The Tonight Show for way back when.
Right, yeah. He did stuff on early television all over. He did this odd program on public television called Meeting of Minds, where he would bring four historical figures onto the stage with him. You know, these are actors
portraying people long dead.
Yeah, like Socrates and Marie Antoinette and Paganini and Thomas Edison, something like that. He'd bring you know, over a period of 2,000 years, these four figures, they'd talk about their lives, each one individually a bit, and then they'd sit down for a discussion, and they would always end up in some big argument, and Steve Allen would have to call an end to the proceedings because they were all shouting at each other or something. I've tried to go back on YouTube and watch some of it. It wasn't really very good. But for me, it was like it opened this door into this world that I just didn't know existed, that their ideas that go back way in the past that are still relevant to our lives and really important, like the arguments these characters were having about their ideas, like touched upon how we live, how we do very basic things in our lives, how we understand politics, how we understand religion and society and everything else. And so that kind of opened this door. But what I started out saying is, like, I had all this help. There were programs like that. There were all these books I talked about. That's what I want to do. I want to provide something like that.
And you said now and at the beginning of the show that this has always been important, but maybe is especially important now because we live in a society where there's so many distractions. And I guess what I would sort of stack on top of that is that we also live in a society where people think about themselves a lot more than they think about others. And we've talked numerous times, and there's been numerous studies that show people are spending more time alone than they did before. And not that you can't spend time alone and think, you know, I'm sure a lot of the preparation for this lecture series you did alone, right? I mean, it's not like that's a bad thing, and it's not offer times for reflection, but certainly when many people are alone, and I'm guilty of this too, you feel like you want to be distracted. And then there's, you know, endless amounts of short form video and long form movies and television shows to eat up your time. And I guess what I'm curious to hear you talk a little bit about now is we've had as a country a long, well, a many years long debate about like the dangers of children and cell phones. And in fact, later this month, we'll have our annual prediction show. And one of your predictions was that we're going to have more legislation taking cell phones out of schools. And that's something that's certainly been going on and been a topic, right? You have parents more aware of the dangers of cell phones and social media in the hands of young people. But I don't feel like we take that far enough sometimes, is that we can obviously make rules and laws and regulations around phone use for young people, and that's even been tried more dramatically in other parts of the world. But I don't think we are as critical of the phone use that adults have, and I guess, should we as a society be more critical of how, whether it's people spending times on phones or doing other sort of less productive ways that we are not advancing our societal cause, should we be as a society more critical of those things? And because, like you said, we don't have, in many cases, the strong influence of religion or other sort of social groups applying that pressure in ways that we've had for, you know, generations, a lot of that's sort of gone. And it is up to people more individually to make those choices. And I just sometimes worry that we're not, as a society, influencing those decisions as strongly as maybe we could.
Yes, I believe very strongly in that. I think our lives are becoming more shallow, more superficial. And I find it myself too. It is so easy at night after working all day to come home and sit down and see what's on Netflix or Amazon Prime or HBO, something like that, instead of reading a novel, for example. And I mean, that's how I used to spend my evenings. I would often be reading novels, and I've realized, like, I don't read nearly as much as I used to. I have to force myself into it. I would say even this project, this is one way of like forcing myself to engage with something that's really substantial. And we have to force ourselves to do it in the same way we have to force ourselves to exercise, right? Because it's hard work. Like, we feel better when we're thinking about things that we know are important, and we grow as a result. But it's so easy now to rest in the superficial, in the state of permanent distraction. But, you know, when we talk about kids, we're doing a real injustice to kids where we're offering them this lifestyle. I think it happens to all of us. That's what I'm saying. Like, I find it in my life too, but with kids, I mean, I am so grateful that I was often in situations where I was really bored. And so, like, reading something that was challenging would be in a way a form of entertainment. But if I had constant forms of distraction when I was a teenager, I doubt if I would have tried reading any of the things that I ended up experimenting with.
So you mentioned, like, exercise is good for us. And I think, you know, most of us could probably exercise more and become more physically fit. However, we do as a society have things, you know, on the private side, like gyms and even the local YMCA, which, you know, encourages people to get out and play basketball or swim or do cardio or all those good things. And even from a broader public policy standpoint, we do invest some money in trail systems and bike paths, in all sorts of things to encourage that behavior. And I think, you know, there is, you know, if you spend a weekend or a week out in nature exercising, you'll feel pretty good about yourself. And I think people are kind of admire, oh, you look at Rick. He spent, you know, you people like, oh, he ran a half, not that you ran a half marathon, but if that person runs a half marathon, and we kind of, like, you know, give people a pat on the back. I just don't see those same levers being used in, and I don't know what those levers might be, but having people be more thoughtful about how they spend their time and whether, and again, I'm sure part of that in your calculus would be spending more time with other people, developing those relationships, having thoughts about what, you know, the search for meaning as this book and lecture series talks about. Is there any way that as a society we can make policy that encourages that, or is that just something that we have to do entirely on our own?
I think policy generally follows from the cultural change, a cultural recognition. So I don't think policy leads it. I think we are becoming, in some ways, there's more attention on exercise and nutrition now in the last 5 years or so than there has been at any time in my lifetime. And I think that eventually the same thing will happen with our mental lives, but it's not happening right now. And I think there's something parallel going on. From the 1970s, 80s, 90s, we were really developed using a lot of technology to make our physical lives easier.
And we succeeded.
We succeeded. But then we start noticing, like, we've got an obesity crisis. We've got children developing diabetes, and even now we've got children developing colon cancer and things like this that used to be diseases of old age. And now they're, like, so there's something profoundly wrong with our levels of physical activity and nutrition. And it takes a society a while to recognize, like what's going on. We've done something really wrong. And so then you get a pushback, you get more emphasis by a certain percentage of the population saying, like, well, how can we eat better? How can we exercise more? So even though we don't have to survive, we can feel better about ourselves. I think the same thing is happening right now with our brains. We've got this real push now. AI, for the first time, is making all kinds of intellectual work obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are thinking, oh, that's a great thing. Like, we'll get so much more done.
But what it really means is, oh, I'll have more time to scroll TikTok.
Yeah, and this is disastrous for our brains.
Yeah.
I mean, what is going to happen if the less we're having children do intellectual work in schools, like, the less they will be prepared to do any kind of thinking about anything that takes discipline, focus, concentration. These are all skills that have to be developed. I foresee that we're going to see really increasing rates of dementia. Dementia is already expected to double from 2025 to 2050 worldwide. A lot of that is because we're just not using our brains.
Exercising our brains in a way.
Exactly. Yeah. And so this is why, for example, having robust social connection shows a 30 to 50% reduction in rates of dementia. But also, like any kind of new experiences that you're doing. So using your brain in new ways is really healthy. AI is promising to do all this stuff for us. And I don't think that's a good thing, but I don't think our society has come to a point of recognizing it. We're still thinking of intellectual work as just work that we could get rid of. We can offload to something else. And so I think we'll see an increased need for this, but I don't think we're there yet.
As you mentioned, you'll be spending much of this next year working on this book and in making the first draft. So people who are listening to this right now who might be eager to explore the meaning of life, that's not what we call it. We call it the search for meaning, which is a little different. But people who are eager to take on that search will have to wait at least a year to read your book. In the meantime, what things would you recommend people do now that make them appreciate or maybe investigate more some of the themes that you've touched on over these past few weeks?
I would suggest reading anything that is at least 100 years old, 100 years old or older, so that we're engaged with people who are thinking about a world that in some ways similar to ours, but also quite different, and different mainly, and it's more of a pre-technological world. And it doesn't matter if you're reading novels or history or philosophy or religion, like whatever it is, what you're just going to do is you're going to encounter ideas. It's going to force you into deeper patterns of thinking that were characteristic of people who were thinking in a pre-technological age.
Yeah, I was talking with a friend just the other day who just got done reading Moby Dick. And maybe actually now that I think about it, it may have been his second time reading it. I think his first time was many years before. And he said much of what you said is that, you know, clearly Melville, the author, knew this topic really, really well. And, you know, and I'll be the first to admit I've not read this novel. Have you?
No, I haven't.
You haven't? Okay.
I've read a lot of stuff by Melville.
Yeah.
I started Moby Dick twice. I've read the first chapter twice.
And
then it's a big commitment.
Yeah.
And I got interrupted. So then I ended up.
Those darn distractions.
Yes.
But he said that we didn't talk about this in huge detail, but he did say it, like, just like you outlined, it does take you back to a different time where if you ever had a question what it was like to be out on the high seas was it the 1800s at some point?
Yeah.
This book is going to take you there.
Right. Another author I'd recommend very highly is Jane Austen. And, you know, like we've seen all kinds of TV and movie treatments of Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility and a lot of her other novels. Yet the books are just amazing. Like I think Jane Austen is probably the finest novelist ever. There's a lot of critics.
That's a big statement.
It's just so reading like her prose is just delightful, but it's both funny and quite deep. I mean, what she is she's primarily an observer of virtues and the importance of virtues in our interpersonal relations. And so I would say start with Emma. Emma is my favorite of all of her novels.
And that's not one of her best known, is it?
Not really. And there's a pretty significant flaw in the plot that critics will point out, but the character Emma is fantastic, and so I really love Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, George Eliot, who wrote Middlemarch and Silas Marner and a lot of other novels. So, but there's so many fascinating novelists. If you just go back 100 to 150, 200 years, and then you know, go back and try reading like some Greek and Roman, some medieval things, and you don't have to spend a lot of time. And there was a lot of short books like you can read, but you know, Caesar's History of the Gallic War, something like that. I mean, it's really fascinating stuff.
I don't want to turn this into like a book podcast, but I just have one follow-up question on this because I know it's something you have an interest in. That, you know, Jane Austen, I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but spends most of her time writing about the era in which she lived and the place in which she lived. And that's obviously very, very common, Melville too. But there's also a whole, and maybe this certainly is, I guess, later than them, but I'm thinking of people like Tolkien or C.S. Lewis who write about these fantasy worlds that certainly they weren't living in and we're not living in today. Does that also sort of offer that same experience, or is that just a whole different thing?
I think Tolkien does, and Tolkien primarily because he's such a student of medieval literature. He's been absorbed into that world, and so he's writing out of that. And so, and his writing is getting close to 100 years old now. Yeah. Like when he was already writing a lot of this stuff in the I think in the 20s and 30s. Like it doesn't come out until later, but he spent decades working on developing his mythology. C.S. Lewis, less so, but C.S. Lewis is a fascinating writer. I really like reading his essays and his short books. I don't think he was a very good novelist, even though he's known for like the Chronicles of Narnia and several others. And they're fine. My entrance into kind of fantasy literature came with reading the Chronicles of Narnia when I was 12 years old. And so like I remember them really fondly, but I haven't been able to go back and read them because they're dumb. But Tolkien, I can reread The Lord of the Rings at any time and I can just pick it up and open it and be right back in that world. I mean, it's really fascinating literature.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, here is my question for you. And I'll warn you that I'm going to ask this question. It's a very intentional reason why I may get into, or I will get into as we talk about it some more. But here is the dilemma as written. You, Rick Kite, own a small restaurant that is extremely popular on weekends. There is constantly a line, and people often leave unhappy because the wait is simply too long. As the business owner, do you consider raising your prices only on the weekends so you can pay your staff better, reduce crowding, and, well, perhaps even earn a little more money?
I would say, especially if you think your staff is underpaid, yes. Like that would be I think that would be an equitable way to do it. And if there's more demand, you can, hotels do this all the time.
Yes. I mean, right? Hotels and airlines have been doing this for as long as I can remember.
Yeah. Restaurants generally don't, I don't know of any that do this, but I don't see anything wrong with it. You're imposing some kind of cost, right, to go on weekends. And the cost can be dollars or it could be time where you have to spend more time waiting. So you're just choosing like which form of cost do I want to impose? So I don't see anything wrong with that.
So the reason I asked the question is there is a very popular Facebook group in our community that focuses on local restaurants, and it has, I think, sprung up around COVID, maybe even in reaction to like sort of struggling businesses around that year or so. But has, obviously that's in the past and it's really grown. And for a community our size has a large, large following. And I am on there occasionally just to learn about new restaurants, things people like, things people don't like. But I went in there recently to share an experience I had. And we, a couple of weeks ago, had a friend visiting from the Twin Cities area, and he has been to our city here in La Crosse a number of times over the years. And he said to us, he said, of all the times I've visited the La Crosse area, the best breakfast I ever had was at a certain place. I'd really like to go there. Oh, well, of course, we can make that work. And I said, well, I checked their website and this particular place, and of course, I'm not going to name it here on the show, but opens at 9 a.m. on Saturday. By the way, they're not open on Sunday. So I said, but that's fine. I said, I know they can be busy. I know the place is not very big. So I said, we should really plan on getting there right at 9 o'clock when they open. We pull up, and the first, in this kind of an area where there's not a whole lot else around, and my first worry is when I pull into the street where it sits, there wasn't a parking spot to be found, and which like, oh, what's going on? So we park the car. I think we arrive at the door literally at 9:01 a.m. And it was a cold winter morning, and there was already a line stretching out of this restaurant. And I kind of was able to poke my head inside because it had been maybe a year or so since I had been in. And yeah, my recollection was right. There's probably only like 10 tables in there. And there's a sign by the door that says they have a new ordering system where you stand in line, you get to the counter. So they used to have, you know, servers who would come to your table and take the order. They don't do that anymore. You stand in line, you place your order, and then that's where I didn't understand what happens next, because by this point, by 9:01, every table was already filled, people waiting for food. So let's say you're patient and you stand in line and you place your order, and then your food's ready, and then, like, there's no place to sit. I mean, I just don't even know how that works, and there didn't seem to be any, like, orderly way to handle this. I mean, a lot of times you have a busy restaurant, you know, take a number, or we'll let you know when your table's called, but this wasn't how it works. You order, and then I guess magically hope, like, a table appears. So it just seemed to me like this seemed to be a disordered situation. So I went on there onto this Facebook page and sort of shared these concerns, and I'd like to think that instead of just sharing, complaints, it's always good to come up with solutions. And my solutions were they could consider, well, one, opening earlier, because if there is a line every day, every Saturday at 9 a.m., you know, maybe opening at 7 or 8 might be an answer. Who knows? Two, another option would be, obviously one option would be have a bigger restaurant, but maybe that's just not possible economically. I don't know. So option two would be if you do have this small restaurant, take reservations. And that would I'm sure they'd fill up and those people have a good experience. And then, you know, that's the way things work. Or three, like the topic today was, you know, maybe just, I mean, clearly there's an overwhelming demand. And again, like my friend said, the food, and I would agree, the food's really good. So why not just like raise the prices on during the weekend or the Saturday you choose to be open? And that would sort of take care of the market, would sort of react accordingly. And that last suggestion about all of my suggestions, by the way, were pretty unpopular on this Facebook page because, you know, people, well, you've never run a restaurant. What do you know about this? Well, I mean, I haven't run a restaurant, but I'm not, you know, the whole.
But you've eaten at
them. I've eaten at them. And like the whole point of this page is to like share your opinion about things. So like whatever. But it did kind of get me wondering. And like you just said, hotels and airlines, I can't remember a time where they don't think they use this term, but now we call it dynamic pricing, where you know there's a demand for something, and in hotels and airlines, there's just a set number of seats or a set number of beds. And if there's an event coming on or everybody's flying home for Christmas, you just know you're going to pay a little bit more. And as technology has improved, even small businesses have a way to use some predictive information to say, hey, we're always seem to be busy around this time of the year. Maybe we'll raise prices. And I promise to let you respond. This is kind of a long windup, but I remember reading a story years ago where there were, and you don't even see these as often, I don't think, as you used to, but those sort of standalone pop or soda dispensers, depending on where you live in the country, that would just sit out along on a beach or on a busy street. And they were designing them maybe 10, 15 years ago that the price of a Pepsi would be higher on a hot summer day than it would be on a rainy Tuesday afternoon.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I think that really proved unpopular. So I think in many cases they stopped doing that because it just seemed like a money grab. But like, you aren't selling Pepsi or cooking people breakfast because you're just a wonderfully altruistic person. Like, all of these businesses are money grabs, right? And I just don't see like a ethical problem with that. So more broadly, after this long monologue, is dynamic pricing bad? Is it, as a business owner, is it something that just helps you kind of manage your business better, or does it show people that you're just a greedy person?
I think it can be bad in some cases where you're but I want to say this. I would rather see dynamic pricing than like a small restaurant who has limited capacity go out of business, where it's really offering a service in the community, providing a really good breakfast, mm-hmm. but they have limited space. They go out of business because they can't pay their staff.
Yep, or can't attract staff.
Or can't attract staff. So like, because I was going to, for 15 years, having breakfast on every once a week with some friends at a local place that had been open for years, and it just closed like four or five years ago. But I always thought the prices were way too low.
Yeah.
Like four of us would have like eggs and toast and bacon or something like that. And we would take turns paying, you know, so lots of times it would be $15.
For four of you.
For four of us to have breakfast and coffee, you know, and so then with a tip, it's $20. Well, you know, how do you stay open on that price? And sure enough, they didn't, right? I would have rather seen them raise their prices. I would have gladly paid more and still had that place, and it would still be employing people. So I don't see anything wrong with dynamic pricing, especially if that, like, that's a way of staying in business. Now, the other thing is, I don't think it's a bad thing to have a long wait either. Like, you create more interest lots of times when there is increased demand.
Well, on my Facebook post, probably the most the first comment that I saw was, thanks for posting this. Now I know where the good breakfast place is in your city.
Yeah, and it reminded me of the Seinfeld episode of the Soup Nazi,
mm-hmm.
right? Like something gets popular and then the Soup Nazi can afford to tell people that you're just not serving them anymore. It's not a bad thing to have real interest and more demand than supply for something, and you don't know how long that's going to last. Now, the other thing I was thinking when you were telling that story is the idea in that restaurant, and I don't know what restaurant you're talking about.
Well, we'll talk about that when we turn off the show.
But is the idea that they'll have you place the order first and then coordinate it. So when the table is being cleared, they can send in the order to the chef so it starts being made. So it's ready. When you sit down, that breakfast is ready for you so that you don't have that 10 to 15 minute delay.
Yeah, I would love to know the answer to that. And in my short stay there, because it was, you know, the line was standing, was stretched outside, it was chilly. But my other criticism of this whole experience was there was like no communication like how this works. All I know is that you order and they bring you food and I guess magically, hopefully a table clears up. But obviously people sometimes eat slowly. Sometimes people are in a hurry. And like the last thing you want is a hot plate delivered to you. And you're like, where do you go? I mean, I don't know how that works. And like, so if there would have been somebody there or some, I guess, possibly really detailed instructions saying, hey, we know we're busy, but here's like a really orderly way to make this situation run as best as it could, that would have been appreciative. Because I do think, and I think, I mean, I want to get into like, we had our book show earlier, and now we can talk about restaurant critiques. But I think most people get into running a restaurant because they like good food and they like to create good food. And probably the opposite example of this is Domino's Pizza. I mean, Domino's Pizza is not awful, but like it's not like gourmet pizza, right? And I remember a couple of years ago reading a story about Domino's Pizza, and the premise of the article was at some point Domino's stopped being a food and a restaurant company and became a technology company, because Domino's is really good at is they have a great app, they have a great delivery system, they have these, you know, they prompt you along the way, they have an easy way to pick up your food. So like that part of the business, they've got nailed. The food, I mean, I'm sure there's people listening who love Domino's pizza, but it's like objectively fine, right? It's not like the best pizza you're ever going to have, but they have figured out the ordering and technology piece. And I would argue the place I talked about earlier could learn a little bit from that. I think restaurants do have a responsibility, obviously, to cook good food, but also to make the whole customer experience smooth and kind of, I don't want to say frictionless, but just make it transparent and make it so it's not like a hassle for people. And
yeah, and it's where a lot of restaurants fail at.
Obviously, I'm sure Domino's has like a whole team of people that can like optimize the customer experience. That's, I think, the phrase people like to use. But I think these small places could do a little better job of optimizing the customer experience. And I would argue part of that might be, you know, if you have a big long line, raise your prices 20%, the line's going to be shorter and life will be better for you.
So the restaurants are, they're feeding people, but they're not really providing a basic need, because you can always get your nutrition elsewhere.
Yeah.
You can go to a grocery store and pick up things. You can eat at home, or even if you're visiting, you can eat in a hotel room, whatever. So they aren't going to make people starve by raising the prices. Exactly. So like restaurants, they're a luxury service. Mm-hmm. And so I don't see the objection for them using dynamic pricing for a luxury service. I would object to grocery stores doing dynamic pricing.
Yeah, that's right? A good point.
Right, but not
like
not,
like the, like I always think, I don't know this to be true, but it seems to me like the Sunday before Thanksgiving is like the last day you want to go grocery shopping, because it's always busy for reasons we all understand. It would not be ideal if, you know, grocery store operators said, hey, that Saturday and Sunday before Thanksgiving, we're going to quietly dial up prices 5%, would be probably bad.
Yeah.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also, be sure to find Rick's column about ethics on all Lee news sites. Also, we will link to the YouTube page where, if you missed any of Rick's series on the search for meaning, you can watch the entire lecture series on YouTube and listen to past podcasts about the series. Please take time. I think you would find it useful. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thanks for listening.